when you ask your question to introduce yourself and maybe say where you're from within the university or in the community. Thanks.
Hi, Lisa. Yeah.
This is just for clarification. So
yeah.
I'm Lisa Cahill. I'm from the theology department.
Yeah.
And my area is social ethics, but I really don't know anything about Islam to speak of. The clarification is, you mentioned that in Turkey there are all federally governed schools.
Yeah.
And you start off by saying there are no religious schools, like
yeah.
Catholic,
private religious schools, yeah.
Islamic fundamentalists.
Right.
So I was unclear about the status of a category that you subsequently mentioned, which was religious schools.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned Imam Hatibi schools, which seem to be secondary education.
Yep, secondary. Yeah. They're religious vocational schools.
And do they
and
also
they're run by
have
the state.
A general secondary curriculum like the other schools?
Yeah, that's.
But they are religious schools.
It's a good right. That's a
yeah.
good question. It's confusing.
Yeah.
They are secondary schools, equivalent to general Anatolian high schools, as they're known, the sort of general program of secondary education. They, until I think maybe 15 years ago, maybe Beryl can help me out, but I think until about 15 years ago, they had less of a general curriculum. And so they were more focused on becoming imams or religious functionaries of different sorts. And people who went to those schools generally worked for the government's religious ministry, religious directorate. In the past 15 years, as I understand it, the curriculum has expanded to where now the religious training component, which means coursework on how to read the Quran, the life of the prophets, religious and cultural values, Islamic calligraphy, these kinds of classes, are now 40% of the curriculum, and 60% is matches in substantial ways the curriculum of general education there, so that students are now able to be admitted to colleges in Turkey on the same basis that students in general high schools are, but they are given a state-sanctioned religious education, not just education about religion, but religious education. So when I mentioned there's no religious schools, I meant in the way that we're talking, the way that we think of here in the United States, there are no private, there are private schools in Turkey, but they are no religious private schools. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You might add there are Armenian and Greek public schools.
Yes, right. Right. So, yeah. Pick,
So in the, I'm Amy Nanza from the Political Science Department. So in the, I was curious about the Armenian and the Greek schools. Do they too say this, I am a Turk?
I can't say. For I it's a national.
It's like the Pledge of Allegiance.
Right. It's a national pledge. I think so as well.
If you're Kurdish, you still.
That's right. And so part of the constitutional reforms have been to allow, the constitutional reforms proposed will allow more openness to, say, Kurdish language classes. There have been some administrative lightening of administrative laws to allow Kurdish to be used in some districts now in the southeast. But that's a new development and hopeful one for, pluralism in the country. Yeah.
And just in addition, to clarify also this question about Imam Hatib's, the state has very strict control over the mosques as well. So all the mosques are state property. And the imams are also state officers.
Mm.
So state has very strict control on that still, even with AK Parti. And in that sense, the state wants to recruit their own imams. So that's why the state wants this. And you should also know that there was a communism threat. And the schools were actually supported by very secular military generals against communism. They wanted to have control over the Islamic education, but they also wanted to impose their way of Islamic education. They wanted to keep that balance.
Yeah, one of the things that I heard on the street, not just in our groups with there, but talking to other people, is that there is a sense of that government ownership of religious education and of mosques is a bulwark against fanaticism. I mean, that's a common refrain there. That if we let anyone take up any mosque, any position of influence, then we'd be risking fanatical Islam, and that's absolutely not what is wanted by the broad. So you see the establishmentarian question is one based on control at all margins. Yeah.
I wanted to ask if the Ministry of Education has any influence, formal or informal, over the education of Turks in Germany.
I have no idea. Okay. Does anybody else know? Jim, do you know?
Well,
the Bureau?
Yeah, we'll talk about the Hizmet. You maybe talked about that network. That would be one example.
Yeah, that's
yes.
They are effective. Actually, Jonathan Lawrence is right now in Turkey.
Yeah.
Actually, sorry, in Germany.
Yeah.
Who's in his sabbatical and his upcoming book will cover that. He also visited Turkey, and he's doing research on that. There are about 3-4 million Turks in Germany, and the Turkish government certainly has interest in helping them, but up until like the last 10 years, they didn't have much effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say the students over there are mostly assimilated. But lately, the government started new initiatives supporting this education, their education. They also have special schools for them in Turkey to get better education.
Yeah.
Like the students who grow up there can come to Turkey for free university education.
Mm.
And on the civil side, the Hizmet movement is also very active, helping these kids to adapt to the community and get better education.
And I know there are the German government sponsors a school in Istanbul, right? Is one of the it funds. There's American, French, and German schools in Istanbul also that keep that round trip connection in play. Yeah.
Thank you for your presentation.
Sure.
It's great to hear more about this project that you know I see going on here at our center. But it's nice to hear more information. I wanted to get a sense of if there's any kind of pushback within. Turkish society about this way of proceeding and how the government has responded to that.
Push back to the general accommodationism of religion,
yes.
The expansion of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. What does that look
there's
like?
Great. Well, again, I'll have to. A lot of people in the room are more familiar with this than I am and read the Turkish language commentary. But my understanding is that there's deep worry. There's generalized worry about losing the restraints that allowed the country to be where it is, the secular sort of rails that kept it on a pathway away from extremism, and there's deep suspicion over and over again. We read and talked about a deep cultural embrace of conspiracy and frequently the reality of conspiracies against the government and by the government and among different religious groups. And the Hizmet movement is the object of many, many conspiracy theories, and the government is, and the military generals are, and there's a culture of conspiracy that makes suspicion embedded. And Jenny White is a professor at BU, and she's an authoritative voice on Turkish culture, and she has written in her latest book that the sort of culture of fear is at the root of Turkish nationalism, the idea that we have internal enemies and external enemies, and we define ourselves as a constant group of blood warriors engaged in protecting our country over and over again. Every new generation needs to defend itself against those who would pollute its values. And so she said that there's a, her new book is about a redevelopment of this identity that's not based on that fear and a more self-confident assertion of what she calls Muslim nationalism. And so it remains open to me. I mean, these gentlemen and others they should speak up as well. But I think there's great worry about it among the percentage of the population that is anti-religious, desperate worry that Erdogan is a Islamist who is trying to extinguish the free culture that they have there, and among those who are who support a secular environment but are not anti-religious, there's some worry of a spillage between that system as well. So I think there's a lot of worry, but also a lot of hope among people who feel that their rights as religious people and their culture has been suppressed for 80 years, and that this is an unbinding of their way of life, that finally they can be themselves and be a part of public culture in the way that many Americans can certainly respect and appreciate. You know, and that's one of the ironies of the EU conversation, is that in order to, join the EU, there needs to be an expansion in some ways of religious rights, and yet the Europeans are very anxious about the expansion of Muslim religious rights, and so that's been a big problem in that conversation. Do you guys want to add on that?
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I'm from Turkey as well.
Oh, good. Welcome.
But I'm Kurdish.
Okay.
I'll provide a completely different perspective, I will say.
Good. Can you tell
First
me your name?
My name is Demet.
Hi.
And I study educational leadership here.
Great.
You described Turkish education system. You're a very good observer.
Oh, good.
So my own understanding is that Turkish identity, as you described in the text, is very exclusionist. It has been so since the beginning of the state. They were secular and they were very Turkish.
Mm-hmm.
So they excluded Islamic people and then Kurdish people.
And by Turkish, just for other people, you mean ethnic Turks? Yes.
What does
you
that
mean? As a linguistic, ethnic, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
I think Americans see everyone who lives in Turkey as Turkish, and it's important to recognize that that's not perceived to be the case.
I usually say I'm from Kurdistan, part
yes.
of Turkey, because I don't want to continue.
That's
that
important.
Sign.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yes,
good.
So,
yeah.
Well, right now, I think the problem with the religious practice here is different than religious practices in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
And especially coming to a Catholic school and having a chance to compare, I realize that religion here is more based on social justice, giving rise to different voices, and giving, you know, you talk about gay marriage, which is
mm-hmm.
unimaginable in Imam Hatip schools.
Mm-hmm.
And in Turkish schools, it's more about always one sect of the country. Like, if the Islamists on the power, they take their own control of the system. As you talked about networking,
mm-hmm.
they create networking and take the control and, you know, live a happy life when they're in the power. But when secularists come, then they suppress the others,
mm-hmm.
Islamists, and they enjoy the system. But
mm-hmm.
Kurds are always at the bottom. They never have the chance to, even when we had a half-Kurdish president, when he said about, when he talked about Kurdish rights, he was described as exclusion. He was, like, separatist.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you talk
yeah.
about Kurdishness,
mm-hmm.
right now, Recep Tayyip Erdogan faced the same thing. He's described as separatist because of talking about Kurdish rights, which is not actually authentic
mm-hmm.
either. I would like to see also, like, just a comment. Islam needs to more focus on social justice and equality.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than favoritism, favoring a certain part of the society. And that anthem that you mentioned, like, how happy that I'm a Turk.
Yeah.
I said it every day before going to school. So
uh-huh.
I was ashamed of my identity being a Kurd, like, because our language was forbidden in the schools. It's so emotional
mm-hmm.
thing to say. But the teachers would say, no, not Kurdish. Did I hear any Kurdish and stuff? So,
mm-hmm.
And still, if you talk Kurdish, I feel anxious in the buses. And I've
mm-hmm.
faced a few cases where people would say bad stuff to people who talk Kurdish. So
mm-hmm.
I think we need to definitely give rise to different people from different groups, like including
mm-hmm.
Kurdish and Islamists.
Mm-hmm.
But we need not to favor one, which is
mm-hmm.
right now, it's definitely Islamist group.
Mm-hmm.
They're at the top, they have the power. But we need to distribute this power to all voices.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about Turkey, remember that 20 million, more than 12 million are Kurdish.
Mm-hmm.
So which constitute like 30% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of Armenians. And you say, for example, 99% is Muslim, but most of Yazidis or most of Armenians are not described as Christian in their identity card. That's another
mm-hmm.
part of it. I think it's more than 1% or 2% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Turkey needs to be more, needs to provide more freedom
yeah.
to different voices.
Well, thank
we are
you.
So backwards. And secularism, I think, is not a way of modernity. Like, we are not
mm-hmm.
a good model for the Middle East, definitely. I don't
mm-hmm.
think so.
Mm-hmm.
Just because we ban people to wear headscarf doesn't mean that it's a good society.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually bad society.
Mm-hmm.
Because your freedom is certain, you're giving, you're excluding certain part of the population. So I think if Iran do a better job in excluding the religion, like Sharia, I think they're much better than us. All of the Middle Eastern countries that where Kurds live in did much better jobs than Turkey did so far. Turkey was the most exclusionist society in my view.
Mm.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your, one quick question. I really appreciate your comments. Are you hopeful about the constitutional changes that they might happen and that they might benefit Kurds?
Well, I read the short descriptions of every party that
yeah.
they propose their constitutional like summary.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that they still continue with the same discourse. Like, they say that the language is Turkish, and
mm-hmm.
some, like, MHP party says
mm-hmm.
that it's religion is Islam.
Nationalist party.
Yeah, nationalist party.
Mm-hmm.
Extreme national patriot, I would say. So, but Kurdish party, I read their own description. They are very liberal in the terms that they describe the state as an agency to provide freedom for their citizens. But all other parties describe constitution as giving rights to, like, describe how the state is, their religion, their language, their identity, their flag. I think, and since Kurdish party really doesn't have any power in the parliament right now, like, they're extremely excluded by other parties, I'm afraid that this won't end in a... It will make the situation better, a little bit better, but still not to a large extent,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Could you address how...
The Armenian
community. Yes, I'm...
That's why I was looking at you.
My family, my father is a survivor of the genocide, 1915 to 1923. He was from Marash, Turkey. That's just his background. I wasn't going to mention it. but I do have a question about writers who are jailed for insulting Turkishness.
Yeah.
That to me is a real block. No matter, that's a block to a democratic society.
Mm-hmm.
So, how is that addressed in the schools? In the schools, are kids, by saying I am Turkish and I'm proud of it, are the kids, I mean, because way back when, you know, in the Ottoman Empire, we all saw ourselves as one people. We didn't see ourselves as separate. We were ethnic minorities, but we were all Kardash, right? And so then that changed. For whatever reasons. But today, in the schools, how are they making children fearful of saying anything that's outside of the accepted line? And if so, is that good education?
Thank you. I mean, the short answer is I can't say. You know, I don't yet have a broad view.
Well, are there any people
here who
were brought up in
it? Speak to it briefly, and other people can come
in.
Yeah,
anybody
but,
here who grew up in a Turkish school, could you address it, please?
Well, I'm actually writing a paper right now about Turkish education system based on two aspects, which is, first, Turkish education system is based on patriotic nationalism, which excludes any other identity, any other religion, any other... And the other one is distortion of facts, which is Armenian genocide and any other massacres that happened so far. So that creates an identity in the Turkish citizens who are more prone to violate further human rights of people. Because whenever you talked about... Yeah, sure.
No, I think, oh.
This is my argument
so
that I'm writing in my paper.
So you feel that it's giving people the power to go ahead and say, yeah, you're Kurdish, you know, don't you dare speak Kurdish. I mean, because we weren't, I mean, my parents, my uncles weren't allowed to speak. In fact, in Well, never mind, they're talking about the early in Marash. But there's been that problem right along. Sometime you can talk about that.
Yeah. No, of
but,
course.
But that concept of not being allowed to speak Kurdish was very frightening to me because it brought back echoes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Very frightening. I mean, I can't imagine anyone not being allowed to speak any language in the streets.
Mm-hmm. That was, you know, in 19th century America, there were attempts to prohibit the use of German in schools, and et cetera. And those were, you know, the important court cases for the United States as well. There's,
so
I mean,
you English only movement.
Right, and there's
yeah.
still English only movements here. I mean, obviously, it's an important marker of identity, and the Turkish government is one of its major problems internationally. Is the fact that it's right now, I believe, it's the country with the most jailed journalists in the whole world, and there are a lot of other offenders out there who you would consider to be pretty bad, and
most of them are Kurdish, by the way,
and
a big majority of them are Kurdish.
Right, and there have been very highly publicized problems with assassinations and people trumpeting their assassination, and then people who criticize the assassins being thrown into jail for criticizing Turkishness. It's a problem, and the culture is not one of free speech. By any stretch of the imagination. So that's clearly a civic educational issue, but I just don't know enough about in the schools to say how it's addressed, you know, to be honest. I want to say what I don't know. Yeah.
So there's a very dark picture here about Turkey.
Yeah.
Well, I would like to, I don't want to go into very much detail, but, you know, to understand current Turkey, you have to look back 600-700 centuries back. So we're talking about Ottoman here, which were in the region for 600 years, and which was like United States. All the nations, they lived together, especially in today's Turkey. So by the end of First World War, they lost the war. They were allies with Germany, actually. And then Atatürk, who was a military general himself, he was the founder of the modern republic, and so you're founding a new country out of Ottoman, ashes of Ottoman. What are you going to name it? What's the identity going to be? You know, we have all the cultures mixed in this land now. So he chose the notion of Turkishness. By the way, most of the Ottoman people, even the founders, they were Turkic origin. They came from Central Asia. So he decided to look back at the history and said, okay, Turkishness. This is the new identity. The 30 million Turks, by then maybe they were 10 million, they're also Turks. So, you know, kids talk Kurdish until elementary school, they don't know Turkish, and they come to elementary school, first day, they're supposed to say, I'm proud I'm a Turk. So, it's a huge problem. But you should also understand this tradition which started by the First World War was kept that way for 100 years. Until 2000, year 2000, the military generals were effectively making sure that this is the system. We had three actual military coups, military takeovers. When there was a Democratic Party who wanted to change the system, who wanted to bring more freedoms, there was a military coup, and the power was handed to another ultra-secular, we call it actually laicist, the French secularism party, and then we had this three times in 60, 70, and 80. And then actually we had what we call the modern coups, the internet coups. The military started publishing their coups online and dictating the government what to do up until 2000 with this new government. So the new government was supported by the majority of the public, and they took that power and went over the military and now jailed those generals who tried to attend more coups, and it's changing now. It's becoming more democratic. So in the last 10 years, actually, this conservative government, they are secular, but conservative, they brought a lot of freedoms, not only for Muslims, but also for Kurds, you will accept, I guess, because they brought a lot of freedoms. The language is now being taught. The government started its own Kurdish language TV channel. They also had private Kurdish language TV channels. So a lot of freedoms are coming. They're still working on it. In terms of constitution making, I don't agree with you because we as a, like a conservative person, I saw it, everybody actually, the majority of the country sees it as a impossible making of a new constitution, because the government, interestingly, they hold, like they get over 50% votes, but they decide to make the constitution by getting two representatives from each party, even from the Kurdish party, right? So everybody has equal voice. Very interesting. And
in the committee,
in the
this
committee,
drafting,
exactly,
not the final thing, but in the drafting committee.
In the drafting committee.
Yeah.
And everybody called this impossible making of a new constitution. They want to keep the old constitution. And the old constitution is made by, after the 1980 coup, by the military generals. And actually all those journals, to address that question as well, the journalists are being jailed because of this constitution. There's not much freedom in it.
But those laws are being used. I mean, there's one thing to have them on the books, it's another to use them.
So we had this very liberal, agnostic journalist, Ahmet Altan, here at Harvard, talking. He answered this question like this. Journalists were being jailed before AK Party, they are being jailed after AK Party, because we still use the same constitution.
Yeah.
So that's the main problem. I just want
okay.
to comment on that.
Well, yeah. The one thing that is, I mean, it's interesting that you start from the Ottoman Empire, because there's a lot of conversation now about the Ottomanization of Turkey, right?
Yes.
Of returning to that multi-ethnic imperial sort of reach, right? That has the influence that the Ottoman Empire used to have, and thinking of that as a model. We visited the 1452, you know, conquest museum when we were there, and there's movies, and you know, just it's a huge cultural phenomenon. And I think that speaks a lot to this striving for identity in the society, and it's going to have religious and political implications that are going to take a while to evolve. But it's a complicated business, and I think those of us who have a stake in it and who are interested in it have a lot to watch out for, to be sure. Yeah, one last, real quick.
Yeah, I'm really fat. If you could go back to the Gulen schools, I'm really fascinated by this phenomenon, because it is an international phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it does remind me of Jesuitism and Mormonism and
yeah.
Calvinism. And all those things do seem to apply to it somehow. And,
yeah.
But it's interesting, because it's, you know, it's affecting the rest of the world. There are many Gulen schools here, and how do you account for the schools in particular? There must be something in their curriculum besides math and science which speaks to a universal appeal.
Yeah.
A universal moral appeal. Because it can't just be that everybody wants their kids to know how to do math and science. There's
mm-hmm.
There's got to be a kind of fundamental decency there I'm interested in what makes possible such a universal phenomenon. And because schools, especially younger, you know, teaching younger children, it must have a moral component.
Yeah.
Even if it's a secular moral education, there are still things that every society wants their kids to be taught.
Mm-hmm.
So that they become decent citizens. And I was wondering if you just had any...
Well, yeah, I think I have a couple things. I mean, I wouldn't call it universal, because I think that, number one, it's the Gulen schools are rooted very deeply in Turkishness and Turkish Islam, and the Hizmet movement is very Turkish-oriented. It's not... it's universal in one sense, that there's a movement of educators among the schools around the world, but it's rooted in particularity, and so there's something interesting about that. When I think about the comments about whether these are Jesuit related, whether they're like Jesuits, the one thing that continually strikes me that's different about the sort of formative impulse of Jesuit schools is that they are humanistic throughout the curriculum. They're not trying to separate the moral formation from the other forms of knowledge that are conveyed throughout the school day. And in talking to Birol and many other folks on this, it seems like this is a legacy of Turkishness to try to keep, even in schools that are outside of Turkey, to keep a separation inside of the school. So that I visited a school that the movement runs in Putnam, Connecticut recently, and Putnam. To the extent that I got the full story, which I think I did, and talked to students and the administrators and everything, I was really honestly astonished that there were no religious education classes and programs during the course of the day. That in a place like the United States where you can do that, and in fact it would seem like a place where you would most want to do that, to say this is where we can let it all, let we can be ourselves, we can have this exact school that we want, they took the model that was rooted in Turkish Islam, which says that the religious and moral formation takes place in our outside of school lives. They make space for prayers during the day and things like that, but the curriculum is not, like here at Boston College and in Jesuit high schools, it's not at all like that. And so that's a very interesting thing to me. I don't know, the whole phenomenon is I'm still learning about and is very challenging to be a part of, but I think that there's something both tremendously hopeful about these schools that are rooted in education and interfaith dialogue, but also lacking in the sort of humanistic study of literature and philosophy and things that I think makes important gestures toward a holistic understanding of our lives and gives us a sort of critical distance that allows those of us who have been educated in that kind of system to find our place in the world. So that's where I am right now, and maybe 6 months from now I'll have a better vision of things.
Thank you so much, Eric.
So thank you all.